Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 82. It's Saturday, October 3rd. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Welcome to the People's School of Public Health in the University of Light. Well, folks, everyone knows the big news this week was that Donald Trump has COVID-19. And in the light of that, I'd like to take a little time to clarify why I named my recording studio Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Well, as many people at first look might recognize, if you're familiar with the German term Schadenfreude, which means taking delight in others' suffering, that's not the primary meaning, actually, although it's kind of clever and funny, I suppose, in that way. And probably a little more seriously, it is related to the universal human desire to see evil thwarted. And I have, over the months of the pandemic, given gentle rebukes to others to consider whether they really want to wish COVID-19 on others. But specifically, why I named my studio the Donald Trump Memorial Studio is really the juxtaposition of two things. There's one certainty in public health. That is, everyone is going to die. That's the foundation of epidemiology, I guess you could say. And I'd like to say, in a lighter note, there's one certainty on this show, and that I am way ahead of the times. So when you put the certainty of public health that everyone is going to die and that I am way ahead of the times, I, you could say, am living with one foot in a future where Donald Trump is no longer alive. And more generally, I'd just like to just note that death is a powerful perspective builder, and I do want to offer fresh perspectives, new perspectives, large perspectives. Old generations will go away and new generations will arise. But also, I guess in the end for today, I'd really like to lift up this bottom line and endorse the public health principle of non-judgment. Ultimately, the job of us in public health is to promote the health and wellness of all. And one of the basic facets of that is valuing all life and not actually wishing non-wellness on people. Although the science of public health, science is basically if the study of if something happens, what follows, there are a lot of questions we can ask regarding the reality that Donald Trump has COVID-19. Or, as I've heard somebody say, they're doubting whether he has it. I'm assuming he does. But either way, you can ask if-then questions, which are scientific questions. It's not just physics or biology. It can be sociology. It can be psychology. It can be political science. There's a lot of different sciences. So it goes. But that's the big news today. Okay. Well, let's get back to it with the local and state update on the status of our COVID-19 epidemic in Lucas County. Here in Toledo, Lucas County, the level of identified new infections has remained fairly flat over the last 2 or 3 weeks. Although interesting, for some unknown reason, the Toledo, Lucas County Health Department is no longer reporting the number of tests performed in Lucas County. That's been over the last week, so it wasn't just a single day. The importance of this is that I can no longer calculate the positivity rate of those tested. And this positivity rate in Lucas County, with the most recent data, which is now over a week old, has been stubbornly high, indicating that testing is not widespread enough to catch most cases. I will have to make a point of calling the health department, finding out what's going on with that. Okay, well, some other data for Lucas County. Nursing home cases, the active cases, stayed steady at 39. And this seems to be a level that it's actually the most popular level, I guess, over the last couple months. Seems to be sort of a set point for us. So I don't know if that's really good or really bad, but it is what it is, I guess. UT down 2 weeks ago, we were at 38. Last week, we were at 46. The most recent week, we've been at 28. I don't know if that's terrible or good or whatever, but I will make a new kind of notice this week in what's happening in the UT campus community. In the surveillance testing over the last 3 weeks, there has been a positivity rate of over 1%, and this is randomly selecting students and staff to get tested. So if you look at the over 20,000 students and staff that UT has, that basically means that at any given time, what the surveillance testing seems to show is that there's 200-plus people in the UT campus community that are walking around that are positive, that are COVID-19 infected. That's a lot of people. So definitely something to look out for and be careful of. Okay, Lucas County Schools. This includes public and private. This has gone up. For last week, we had 10 staff. I reported on 10 staff and 6 students. And this week, it's 10 staff and 11 students. So it's gone up a little bit. This, of course, is identified infections. We don't know, obviously, the true rate. They're not doing surveillance testing as they are like at UT, where they're taking random sampling. This is just based on people who have symptoms, happen to get tested, and the like. Okay, well, let's start the news reporting section of the show with a story from the Columbus Dispatch, an Ohio story. Amid pandemic, May was Ohio's deadliest overdose month in more than a decade. Drug overdoses killed more Ohioans in May than in any month in at least 14 years, a potential side effect of the coronavirus pandemic that leaders fear could flare up again before things get back to normal. At least 532 Ohioans died of an overdose in May, preliminary statistics from the Ohio Department of Health's mortality database shows. By comparison, 381 Ohioans died of an unintentional drug overdose in April, according to state data. The May data is still incomplete. County coroners have 6 months to investigate, meaning overdose deaths could still climb for that month, a state health department spokeswoman said. The startling trend is one that many saw coming, as overdoses often skyrocket in times of despair and economic uncertainty, said Blythe Barnow, harm reduction manager for Faith in Public Life Ohio, which is part of a national network of faith leaders that advocates for legislative reform regarding drug abuse and other issues. When you don't have certainty in the middle of something like this, it creates a lot of anxiety and fear, Barno said. We know anxiety and fear and shame fuel drug use. The group is lobbying for a series of changes to Ohio law to help stem the increase in overdose deaths across the state. First, Barno said the state should adjust its Good Samaritan law to protect people who report overdoses from facing drug paraphernalia charges. Those who report an overdose are already granted immunity at least 2 times when helping someone seek medical attention. The state, Barnow said, should also have a standing order for overdose reversing naloxone and increase funding for needle exchanges and for Medicaid, which is the largest payer of treatment for people with substance abuse disorders. Governor Mike DeWine and his administration plans to announce a strategy to get money into communities struggling with the opioid epidemic. Incidents of drug abuse and mental health issues have increased during the pandemic, causing them to become a recurring topic in the governor's biweekly COVID-19 briefings. Many times those are connected, DeWine said, of mental health and drug abuse. We know that there's been a lot of downsides to this COVID besides the COVID itself. One of the downsides is an increase in mental health issues. Most recently, the Ohio House and State Senate passed House Bill 341, which expands access to naloxone, said Alicia Nelson, Director of Recovery Ohio, a statewide initiative focused on rehabilitation and addiction prevention. The bill, which is set to take effect December 16th, allows pharmacists to dispense naloxone to anyone and permits any person to acquire naloxone and administer it to someone who appears to be experiencing an overdose, according to an analysis from the State Legislative Service Commission. The person administering the drug will not be liable for the overdose of the person they are assisting. Okay, well, as we head into the fall, we expect that we're getting, like every year, into respiratory virus flu season, which of course includes COVID-19. And we have a couple stories that seem to indicate that, as a continuing story, the U.S. states and localities seem to not really learn that when things are getting worse, you shouldn't lighten restrictions. So, here's one story from The Hill. States lift limits on bars despite risk of virus. States across the country are lifting restrictions on bars and restaurants, even as public health experts warn they are a leading source of coronavirus transmission as the country braces for a fall surge. In Florida, a state that was hit hard by the virus over the summer, Governor Ron DeSantis, Republican, announced late last week that he was lifting all restrictions on bars and restaurants, leading to some images of crowded bars over the weekend. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee, Republican, announced on Tuesday he was lifting all coronavirus restrictions on businesses. Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb, Republican, last week lifted all capacity limits on bars and restaurants, though rules still call for physical distancing and having customers be seated. The announcement comes despite public health officials pointing to bars and indoor dining as major sources of transmission, given that they bring people together indoors in close quarters for extended periods of time and people cannot wear masks while eating and drinking. According to the COVID Exit Strategy Tracking Project, there are currently 8 states with more than 25 new cases per day per 100,000 people, which the Harvard Global Health Institute classifies as being in the red zone. Governors have not closed bars in any of those 8 states: Arkansas, Iowa, Montana, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Utah, and Wisconsin, except for Iowa, where the governor has closed bars in 2 counties. Because bars are nationally recognized as COVID-spreading locations, they are still not able to open at this time, Texas Governor Abbott said at a press conference in mid-September. While not as drastic as the steps in place like Florida, bars are reopening with restrictions in some places as well. Las Vegas in mid-September reopened bars with a 50% capacity limit. Chicago is reopening bars with a 25% capacity limit. And Tennessee goes far beyond just bars. From The Hill, Tennessee governor ending all statewide restrictions on businesses and gatherings. Tennessee is ending all statewide coronavirus restrictions on business and gatherings, but also extending its state of emergency over the pandemic, Governor Bill Lee, Republican, announced Tuesday. "I want the economy to move forward," Lee told members of the state legislature on a call Tuesday afternoon, the Tennessean reported. "I don't want any business to have any reason to not function as fully as they possibly can. I'm advocating for that in our big 6 counties as well." The governor plans to impose, quote, "no limits on any businesses," urging the state cities to repeal local business restrictions as well. The order will allow cities to keep mandates in place if they choose to. And from the Grand Forks Herald, Governor Burgum downplays hospital bed shortage as North Dakota further relaxes quarantine guidelines. I'd have to note that North Dakota has the highest rate of new identified infections in the country of any state. Governor Doug Burgum said hospital capacity has not been an issue in North Dakota during the COVID-19 pandemic, despite a statewide shortage of intensive care beds and evidence that some patients are being transported several hours from their homes to receive medical care. Kirby Kruger, the director of the State Division of Disease Control, announced Thursday a change to the state's recommendations for when close contacts of known COVID cases should quarantine. Residents identified as close contacts will no longer be recommended a 2-week quarantine period if they and the positive cases to whom they were exposed wore masks when they were together. North Dakota does not report a 7-day rolling average for positivity rates, but Forum News Service calculated the rate to be 13.2%.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, next I'd like to do three stories related to COVID-19 vaccine development and distribution. This from the New York Times. These coronavirus trials don't answer the one question we need to know. If you were to approve a coronavirus vaccine, would you approve one that you only knew protected people only from the most mild form of COVID-19, or one that would prevent its serious complications? The answer is obvious. You would want to protect against the worst cases. But that's not how the companies testing three of the leading coronavirus vaccine candidates, Moderna, Pfizer, and AstraZeneca, whose U.S. trial is on hold, are approaching the problem. According to the protocols for these studies, which was released late last week, a vaccine could meet the company's benchmark for success if it lowered the risk of mild COVID-19, but was never shown to reduce moderate or severe forms of the disease, or the risk of hospitalization, admissions to the intensive care unit, or death. To say a vaccine works should mean that most people no longer run the risk of getting seriously sick. That's not what these trials will determine. The Moderna and AstraZeneca studies will involve about 30,000 participants each. Pfizer will have 44,000. Half the participants will receive two doses of vaccine separated by 3 or 4 weeks, and the other half will receive saltwater placebo shots. The final determination of efficacy will occur after 150 to 160 participants develop COVID-19, but that is only if the trials are allowed to run long enough. Pfizer will look at the accumulating data 4 times, Moderna twice, and AstraZeneca once to determine if efficacy has been established, potentially leading to an early end of the trials. Knowing how a clinical trial defines its primary endpoint, the measure used to determine a vaccine's efficacy, is critical to understanding the knowledge it is built to discover. In the Moderna and Pfizer trials, even a mild case of COVID-19, for instance, a cough plus a positive lab test, would qualify and muddy the results. AstraZeneca is slightly more stringent, but would still count mild symptoms, like a cough plus fever, as a case. Only moderate and severe cases should be counted. There are several reasons this is a problem. First, mild COVID-19 is far more common than severe COVID-19, so most of the efficacy data is likely to pertain to mild disease. But there is no guarantee that reducing the risk of mild COVID-19 will also reduce the risk of moderate or severe COVID-19. The reason is that the vaccine may not work equally well in frail and other at-risk populations. Healthy adults who could form a majority of trial participants might be less likely to get mild COVID-19, but adults over 65, particularly those with significant frailty, might still get sick. Second, Moderna and Pfizer acknowledge their vaccines appear to induce side effects that are similar to the symptoms of mild COVID-19. In Pfizer's early phase trial, more than half of the vaccinated participants experienced headache, muscle pain, and chills. If the vaccines ultimately provide no benefit beyond a reduced risk of mild COVID-19, they could end up causing more discomfort than they prevent. Third, even if the studies are allowed to run past their interim analyses, stopping a trial of 30,000 or 44,000 people after just 150 or so COVID-19 cases may make statistical sense, but it defies common sense. Giving a vaccine to hundreds of millions of healthy people based on such limited data requires a real leap of faith. Declaring a winner without adequate evidence would also undermine the studies of other vaccines, as participants in those studies drop out to receive the newly approved vaccine. There may well be insufficient data to address the aged and underrepresented minorities. There will be no data for children, adolescents, and pregnant women since they have been excluded. Vaccines must be thoroughly tested in all populations in which they will be used. None of this is to say that these vaccines can't reduce the risk of serious complications of COVID-19, but unless the trials are allowed to run long enough to address that question, we won't know the answer. The trials need to focus on the right clinical outcome, whether the vaccines protect against moderate and severe forms of COVID-19, and be fully completed. It's not too late for the companies to do this, and the Food and Drug Administration, which reviewed the protocols, could still suggest modifications. These are some of the most important clinical trials in history, affecting a vast majority of the planet's population. It's hard to imagine how much higher the stakes can be to get this right. Cutting corners should not be an option. Okay, next up from Discover Magazine, why it'll take more than one vaccine to beat COVID-19. Multiple vaccines might be necessary to account for variations in effectiveness and how well they protect different populations of people. In the rush of the COVID-19 vaccine race, it's easy to forget one important detail. There might be several winners. It's too early to tell which or how many candidates will make it to market, which means some of the administrative protocols or requirements are unknown too. As results start to become clear, we will then have the kind of situation where we'll have more certainty about what's going on and how that will impact vaccination policy, said Saeed Omer, epidemiologist and director of the Yale Institute for Global Health. In other words, it's only after the first vaccine or vaccines receive approval that health officials and policymakers can nail down logistics of how to get people vaccinated. Plus, no matter how good the initial vaccine options are, it may take additional options to help nationwide vaccination campaigns run smoother and faster. What later options could offer? For starters, slower-to-market vaccines could have higher efficacy rates. Again, it's still not clear if that will be the case. And if the scenario does pan out, it doesn't mean that the first vaccine would be ineffective. The FDA has set an expectation that any COVID-19 vaccine would block the disease or reduce illness severity in at least 50% of people who get it. Maybe the first option available will blow past the minimum expectation, Omer says. But if it doesn't, then there's still value in pursuing vaccines that are more likely to convey immunity to their recipients. There's also a future scenario in which the first vaccine works well in younger people but drops in efficacy for the elderly, says William Schaffner, an infectious disease specialist at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. Aging immune systems can struggle to develop strong responses to vaccines, and seniors might need modified formulas to up the odds that they would be protected from getting ill. For a COVID-19 vaccine, whether or not older people would need a different vaccine is still unknown, Omar emphasizes. There hasn't yet been enough data from the various vaccines in development to determine whether they would convey equal odds of immunity across all age groups, but the possibility means there could be room for formulas that work better for that portion of the population. Enhanced options for the elderly already exist for some viruses. A seasonal flu vaccine approved only for people over 65 has four times of the virus-like component, for example. Manufacturers can also add molecules called adjuvants as a way to improve likelihood of vaccination success. Adjuvants can stimulate an immune response to function as if it were younger, says Schaffner. Already, labs are researching adjuvants that, when added to a vaccine, kick off the best immune response possible, regardless of age. Several leading COVID-19 vaccine candidates might also require people to get two doses. People receive several injections for a single preventive treatment all the time. The HPV vaccine, for example, requires two or three shots depending on your age. But as vaccination efforts roll out, single dose options are easier on the supply chain. That's one syringe per person, not two, and let people arrange time for a medical visit just once. There's also the question of how different COVID-19 vaccines might reach people. A couple front runners in development need to be kept at super cold temperatures. We're talking -4 degrees Fahrenheit for the Moderna candidate and -94 degrees Fahrenheit for the two vaccines from a BioNTech and Pfizer collaboration. Medical centers are used to keeping vaccines cold, but current CDC recommendations for optimal freezer temperatures only go as low as minus 58 degrees Fahrenheit, which means many clinics likely aren't set up to store these vaccines. Manufacturers and shipping companies are working hard to assemble enough deep freezers for distribution needs, which should be doable for the entire U.S. It's not a rocket science level technology, Omer says. It's expensive, but it can be done. An extreme cold requirement could become a larger issue in nations with less developed power infrastructure. So in those places, a less deep freeze dependent vaccine could eliminate major barriers to vaccination programs. Of course, one of the largest challenges to vaccinating people against COVID-19 is each individual's willingness to participate. And right now, the federal education plan on the pandemic and COVID-19 vaccine specifically amounts to the CDC website says Omer, we don't have a national vaccine communication strategy, he says, and that blows my mind. Without a concerted education effort, it could be challenging to convince people to go get their injection, let alone remind them if they'll need to go back for a second. Okay, next up, the third vaccine article drills down on this distribution problem of cold temperatures. This from Discover Magazine, keeping coronavirus vaccines at sub-zero temperatures during distribution will be hard, but likely key to ending pandemic. Trucks, planes, and storage facilities all need to be able to keep a vaccine cold. Just like a fresh piece of fish, vaccines are highly perishable products and must be kept at a very cold, specific temperatures. The majority of COVID-19 vaccines under development, like the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, are new RNA-based vaccines. If they get too warm or too cold, they spoil. And just like fish, a spoiled vaccine must be thrown away. So how do companies and public health agencies get vaccines to the people who need them? The answer is something called the vaccine cold chain, a supply chain that can keep vaccines in tightly controlled temperatures from the moment they are made to the moment they are administered to a person. Ultimately, hundreds of millions of people in the U.S. and billions globally are going to need a coronavirus vaccine and potentially two doses of it. This mass vaccination effort is going to require a complex vaccine cold chain on a scale like never before. The current vaccine cold chain is not up to the task, and expanding the supply chain is not going to be easy. Cold chain problems mean wasted vaccines. Most vaccines need to be stored within 1 degree Fahrenheit of their ideal temperature. Traditional vaccines are usually stored between 35 degrees Fahrenheit and 46 degrees Fahrenheit, but some of the leading COVID-19 vaccines need to be stored at much colder temperatures. Moderna's vaccine requires a storage temperature of minus 4 degrees Fahrenheit, whereas Pfizer's vaccine candidate requires a storage temperature of minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit. These are not easy temperatures to maintain accurately. A study from 2019 estimated that 25% of vaccines are degraded by the time they arrive at their destination. If a vaccine is exposed to temperatures outside its range and this gets noticed, then the vaccines are always thrown away. Rarely a temperature mistake is missed and one of these vaccines is administered. Research shows that these vaccines won't cause any adverse effects, but it could offer decreased protection and might require a patient to be revaccinated. Temperature mistakes are mostly due to inappropriate shipping procedures in the cold chain, and these losses are estimated at $34 billion annually. But that number does not even take into account the cost, physically as well as financially, of any illnesses that could have been prevented by timely deliveries of high-quality vaccines. As a scholar of operations management, I study perishable product supply chains in the pharmaceutical industry and how they regulate to product quality. With billions of vaccines needed to address the pandemic, a high spoilage rate would result in an immense financial loss and a huge delay in vaccinations that could result in deaths and a longer global shutdown. The cold chain today. Experts estimate that somewhere between 12 billion and 15 billion COVID-19 vaccines are needed globally. Currently, the world is capable of producing and distributing around 6.4 billion flu vaccines per year. In 2021, experts expect companies will produce around 9 billion COVID-19 vaccines, and the cold chain must be able to handle this huge increase on top of the vaccines that must be distributed every year already. The cold chain requires three major pieces of infrastructure: planes, trucks, and cold storage warehouses. How the infrastructure is connected and utilized depends on the vaccine production locations and the points of demand. Once a COVID-19 vaccine is produced, it likely will be immediately transported by truck to the nearest suitable airport. Since a COVID-19 vaccine is particularly valuable and time-sensitive, it will likely be shipped via air transport across the country or world. After these planes are unloaded, the vaccines will be taken via trucks to appropriate warehouse storage facilities for transportation to distribution facilities. Some of the vaccines may be directly shipped from the warehouses to healthcare facilities where the vaccinations will take place. So what can companies, health agencies, and governments do to help expand the cold chain? The first step will be to identify where the vaccines will be produced. If production is done mainly abroad, companies will need to use trucks and planes for transportation within their own countries and for further distribution to others. There is also a lot of uncertainty about which COVID-19 vaccine will be approved first. Different vaccines may require different temperatures and different handling procedures. Hence, staff throughout the cold chain need different training on how to handle each vaccine. Another question is how frequently deliveries will need to be made to points of care. This will depend on the refrigeration capacity of healthcare organizations and hospitals, staffing resources, the locations of vaccines will be given, and many other factors, including the shelf life of the vaccine itself. Finally, there is a simple problem of how to expand shipping and storage capacity. Typical restaurant freezers have a range of 5 degrees Fahrenheit to minus 10 degrees Fahrenheit and simply can't reach the temperatures required by something like the Pfizer vaccine. Specialized equipment is needed. Several major logistics companies like UPS and DHL are already investing in new storage facilities for cold chain management. UPS is adding freezer farms of 600 freezers capable of reaching minus 80 degrees Celsius near UPS air hubs in Louisville, Kentucky, and the Netherlands. Each freezer will be able to hold 48,000 vials of vaccine and could easily store either the Pfizer vaccine or the Moderna vaccine at the necessary low temperatures. Installing freezers capable of the low temperatures needed by the Pfizer vaccine isn't possible in many places, so it's essential that processes be put in place to make sure that those areas can receive a steady supply of the vaccine. Airport and logistics companies are currently evaluating whether they can meet this need. The results remain to be seen. These are just a few of the major problems and potential solutions, but there are dozens of interesting scenarios that could arise. For example, if the U.S. government gets involved in distribution, there's a possibility that the military would transport vaccines. Constant electricity becomes essential as well. In regions where fire risk is leading to blackouts or in developing nations where the grid is not as reliable, thousands of vaccines could be lost if the power goes out. It is also expected that only certain airports certified for handling pharmaceuticals will be able to accept such valuable perishable cargo, so bottlenecks may occur there. And finally, it is possible that with the airline companies reeling from the pandemic, there might not be enough active planes to meet the demand for shipping these vaccines. Every vaccine produced could save a life and bring the world closer to a return to normalcy, but getting the vaccines to where they need to be is not going to be easy. Preparing and fortifying the cold chain for vaccine distribution will ensure that vaccines are not wasted and will help the world get through the pandemic sooner. Okay, well, one thing's for sure, we're learning a lot with the experience of this COVID-19 pandemic. And next up, I have a story from Politico, which draws on a lot of lessons learned from STD prevention over decades. And this is particularly close to my heart since I worked HIV, AIDS, and sexual health in the 1990s for our local health department. So this from Politico, what STDs can help tell us about how to fight COVID? The cycles of STD infections offer some key insights that may well cross party lines. As COVID-19 has rampaged across the United States, government officials have struggled with the basic steps needed to contain the pandemic. Should everyone get tested or just people with symptoms? Should public health officials require Americans to wear masks or not? What's the best way to track the infection, particularly in marginalized communities? For one set of public health experts, the heated debates over testing, wearing masks, and contact tracing are eerily familiar. As odd as it might seem, these are similar to arguments that officials and academics working to eradicate sexually transmitted diseases have been having for decades as they have worked to bring down the rates of infection, like HIV, syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia. It may seem incongruous, even inappropriate, to compare a respiratory disease to a sexually transmitted infection. After all, it's emotionally harder, if logistically easier, for someone to tell a contact tracer who they've been intimate with than it is to list everyone who has shared their airspace. But the cycles of infection we're watching with COVID are similar to patterns we've long seen in diseases like HIV and tuberculosis, where successful suppression of infection rates is followed by funding cuts and the abandonment of vulnerable communities, allowing viruses and bacteria to make a comeback. Sexual health experts say the lessons they've learned from both these triumphs and failures could make a major difference now in suppressing the coronavirus. Their insights suggest smart ways forward that might well cross party lines, including that you can't fix a problem just with finger wagging and new rules, but you can't wish it away and move on with your life either. Here are the top lessons they've learned that could help battle the COVID-19 pandemic. Number one lesson, from condoms to masks, fear and shame don't work. Sexual health experts who have spent decades promoting condom use have some advice for their public health counterparts struggling to convince people to wear face masks. Attempts to scare or shame people into compliance will backfire. When we tell people, if you don't like wearing a mask, you're really not going to like a ventilator, these kinds of fear-based messages are not very effective, said Julia Marcus, an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School who specializes in HIV prevention. Even if there's truth to them, they make people associate this simple intervention with sickness and death. Similarly, messages that have associated condoms with disease and death didn't exactly make people hot to put them on in a moment of pleasure and intimacy. Marcus says officials should be aware that resistance to wearing condoms and resistance to wearing masks are driven by some of the same misperceptions about their effectiveness and insecurities about manliness, but there are ways to get around them. She pointed to videos produced by California's health department that acknowledge and address head-on some of the reasons people don't wear masks, from concerns it telegraphs weakness to small annoyances like fogging up glasses and making it harder to read facial expressions, as an example of more effective strategy. Experts say mask campaigns should also emulate successful HIV prevention campaigns that appeal to people's altruism, like one popular message developed a few years ago, pushing HIV-positive people to adhere to their drug regimen to protect both themselves and their sexual partners. As with condoms and HIV drugs, the most effective message is that masks don't just protect us, they protect others, and that's not getting across. It's a notion that you're doing good for your fellow person and your community, said Perry Halkitis, Dean of the Rutgers School of Public Health. That's completely lacking in the mass messaging right now. Lesson number two, abstinence is a fool's errand. Researchers who have watched decades of abstinence-only education fail to bring down the number of unintended pregnancies and STDs say the government should not counsel the COVID equivalent of abstinence, strict quarantines, and social isolation. You need to give people safe ways to navigate the pandemic, just like you need to give people safe ways to have sex, Halkitis said. If you don't, people are going to develop mythological understandings of how biology operates so they can accommodate their needs and their desires. Not everybody can work remotely. Many lack space in their home to keep separate from their other family members, and long-term isolation can be emotionally crippling. So, Halkitis and other STD experts say the government should instead adopt a harm reduction approach, one that helps people understand the spectrum of risk of different activities so they can make informed decisions. For instance, if you can stay home, stay home. If you can't, stay 6 feet apart and wear a mask. Outdoors is safer than indoors. Small groups are better than large ones. But so far, there's been more of a black and white, all or nothing approach, reflected in language used by both Democrats and Republicans, like shutdown, lockdown, and reopening, that doesn't convey nuance. Jeannie Marazzo, a physician and HIV and infectious disease expert at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, says a more empathetic and supportive approach from officials, i.e., how can I help you stay safe, works better than a punitive tone that often leads to people doubling down on risky behavior. This approach of vilifying people who violate the rules has never worked, she said. It never worked for HIV or STDs or drug use, and it's not working now for people having frat parties on college campuses. Lesson number three, testing needs to be free, convenient, and routine, or it will fail. The U.S. response to the coronavirus pandemic has been plagued by testing failures, from supply shortages to surprise medical bills to a dangerously inadequate effort to test those without symptoms that have allowed the virus to spread far and wide. These missteps could have been avoided, public health experts say, if the government had ensured from the beginning that testing was universally free, convenient, and routine, and that it covered people regardless of whether they have symptoms. We realized way back in the 1960s and 70s that many, if not most people, with STDs were asymptomatic, and to get ahead of the curve, you had to find the people who had the highest risk and were most likely to transmit it, said Cornelius Reitmeier, the former head of Denver's STD control program. You have to do screening, not just diagnostic testing. Reitmeier cited the hard-won battle that led the CDC recommending in 2014 that all sexually active women under 25 be screened every year for chlamydia as an example of the kind of broad-based strategy that works. STDs that don't have the same level of routine testing like syphilis have seen epidemics. One of the things happening in the U.S. that's a disaster is the increase in congenital syphilis, he said, referring to an STD passed from a pregnant mother to her child. That's something you usually only see in the third world. It's totally preventable if a woman gets tested in her first trimester. Other successful strategies include using mobile vans to bring testing to vulnerable neighborhoods and providing at-home testing kits, some of which allow people to swab themselves and mail the sample into a lab, and others that deliver rapid results at home. Similar mail-in tests for COVID are becoming more available, and testing companies are trying to develop simple, instant at-home tests, like pregnancy tests. But while there are open questions about their accuracy, experts say the government should more aggressively pursue, perfect, and promote this option. Some people experience discomfort in clinical settings, while others say they just don't know where to go to be tested, said John Hecht with the group Building Healthy Online Communities, which has researched how at-home HIV testing kits can expand access. And at home, there's no need to deal with anything related to transportation or taking time off work. Lesson number 4, build trust with marginalized populations. Like STDs, COVID has been far more prevalent among marginalized groups, including communities of color and the poor, who, because of centuries of abuse and neglect by the medical system, are often reluctant to come in for regular testing and treatment of infectious diseases, one reason they have disproportionate rates of both STDs and COVID-19. Advocates and government officials have made some progress on tackling sexual health disparities by pushing local health departments to recruit and hire disease investigators who are from the communities they're trying to reach, and to create messaging specifically tailored to minority groups, two actions they say aren't happening enough during the COVID-19 pandemic. In Arkansas, for example, immigrants from the Marshall Islands comprised nearly 20% of COVID cases in two hard-hit counties, although they made up only 1.5% of the population, according to a CDC team that flew in to investigate this summer. At that time, the state had only one contact tracer who spoke Marshallese out of a team of 200, and its public health phone alerts were not available in that language. But STD experts have learned that hiring bilingual public health workers and translating guidance isn't enough. To build trust, it's essential to have staff who have backgrounds that reflect the communities at highest risk of infection, such as LGBT people, immigrants, the formerly homeless, and those recovering from addiction. Morazzo said she fears inadequate consultation with marginalized groups in the development of a COVID-19 vaccine will mean that people who need it most won't trust or take it if and when it becomes available. A poll conducted in late August found that 72% of Black Americans said they would not get a coronavirus vaccine when it's available, compared to 49% of white respondents. The only way you're going to get something that works for people is to involve them in the research from the beginning, she said. We learned that the hard way with sexual health, and we're making the same mistakes again now. 5. Don't stop something that's working. The U.S. has long been trapped in a dangerous cycle of ignoring and defunding public health programs during times of calm, only to throw money at a problem later when it becomes a crisis. It happened with tuberculosis in the 1960s and 70s, recounted Reitmeier. When TB came under control, they dismantled all the clinics in New York City. Then it increased again, and we were all caught with our pants down. More recently, states and the federal government invested heavily in global health and infectious disease prevention after 9/11 drew attention to bioterrorism threats. But that funding was gutted in the wake of the 2008 recession. It never recovered, allowing STD rates to soar and leave the nation highly vulnerable to the COVID-19 pandemic. The lesson is that prevention works, but what tends to get defunded is prevention, Helkaita said. Putting the money in the front end, while costly, is going to save money in the long run, but we as a country totally suck at that. Leaders like former CDC Director Tom Friedan are lobbying for a permanent health security fund that operates outside of Congress's normal budgetary dealings, so that funding isn't approved only when a pandemic or other crisis is already underway. As COVID-19 deaths level off at the still high rate of around 1,000 per day, experts stress that it's not too late to implement these strategies from the sexual health world and turn the tide of the pandemic. The real danger, they say, is to continue in the current path. People say public health has failed on sexually transmitted infections, Reitmeier said, citing the country's current record rates of gonorrhea, syphilis, and chlamydia. But I say society has failed public health. We've let it go by the wayside. There's been complacency when there is no urgency. Okay, and for some more insights on how to deal with this COVID-19 pandemic, from National Geographic, why misinformation about COVID-19's origins keeps going viral. 20 years ago, data scientist Sinan Errol began to see the formation of a trend that now defines our social media era, how quickly untrue information spreads. He watched as false news ignited online discourses like a small spark that kindles into a massive blaze. Now the director of the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy, Errol believes that a concept he calls the novelty hypothesis demonstrates the almost unstoppable viral contagion of false news. Human attention is drawn to novelty, to things that are new and unexpected, says Errol. We gain in status when we share novel information because it looks like we're in the know or that we have access to inside information. Back in 2018, Errol and his team at the MIT Media Lab put their novelty hypothesis to a test by analyzing 11 years of data from Twitter, or about 4.5 million tweets. Their calculations showed a surprising correlation. What we found was that false news traveled faster, farther, deeper, and more broadly than the truth in every category of information that we studied, sometimes by an order of magnitude, Errol explains. More is at play than just novelty, as Errol discusses his new book, The Hype Machine. The way people react to emotional stories on social media is intense and predictable. Vitriol fills the replies, and false news then becomes 70% more likely to be retweeted than the truth. A complicated combination of psychological factors is at work. Whenever a reader decides to share news, and otherwise smart people can become part of the cycle of disinformation. One factor is knowledge neglect. When people fail to retrieve and apply previously stored knowledge appropriately to a current situation, according to Lisa Fazio, an assistant professor of psychology and human development at Vanderbilt University. The human brain seeks an easy option. Readers cut corners, often sharing stories with grabby headlines before looking deeper into the story itself. Even when social media users do read what they share, their rational mind finds other ways to slack off. For instance, humans are prone to confirmation bias, a way of interpreting new information as a validation of one's preconceived notions. Motivated reasoning switches on too, and the brain tries to force these new conceptual puzzle pieces together, making connections even if they don't fit. The most potent factor that warps critical thinking is the illusory truth effect, which Fazio defines with this scenario. If you hear something twice, you're more likely to think that it's true than if you've only heard it once. So prevalence turbocharges false news, and echo chambers then turn into self-perpetuating whirlwinds of misbelief. Yikes. Okay, I'd like to switch gears just a little bit here and do a couple stories on reproductive health. This from the Nation's Health. Study, rate of unplanned pregnancies still too high. Almost half of all pregnancies that occurred globally in recent years were unintended, according to a new study. The research published in The Lancet Global Health estimated unintended pregnancy and abortion rates by income level, region, and other measures. The study was led by the Guttmacher Institute, a research organization advancing women's health, and the UN Human Reproduction Program. Each year during the 2015 to 2019 study period, there were about 121 million unintended pregnancies, defined as a pregnancy a woman did not mean to have. Over 70 million of these pregnancies ended in abortion. These findings show a clear need for prioritizing a comprehensive approach to essential sexual and reproductive health and rights, including access to safe and legal abortion, which is critical to women's health, particularly during the pandemic and ensuing economic recession, Hermione Palacio, MD-MPH, President and CEO of the Guttmacher Institute, said during a telebriefing. Researchers analyzed data from 166 countries between 1990 and 2019 on pregnancy intentions and abortions. Their findings revealed staggering inequities between women in high-income countries and those in low-income countries. Women in the poorest countries were nearly three times more likely to experience unintended pregnancies than women in the wealthiest countries. But unplanned pregnancies are experienced by women from all socioeconomic groups, said Jonathan Barak, PhD, senior research scientist at the Guttmacher Institute and lead author of the study. Unintended pregnancy and abortion are reproductive health experiences shared by tens of millions of people around the world, irrespective of personal status or circumstances. What differs are the obstacles people face. For example, legal, social, and economic obstacles in exercising their reproductive autonomy. A major obstacle for women with unplanned and unwanted pregnancies is access to safe abortion. Around the world, 24 countries do not allow any abortions, while about 40 allow them only when a woman's life is at risk. The tragic paradox is that currently abortion services are most needed where they are least legally available. Zareed Ahmad, Associate Director of Federal Issues at the Guttmacher Institute, said during the telebriefing. And because abortion is essential health care, people still find ways to get one, even if it means resorting to unsafe methods. While unintended pregnancies have declined overall during the past 3 decades, the abortion rate has returned to levels seen in the 1990s, a study said. Abortion increased by 12% in countries with highly restricted access, but decreased slightly in regions where it is legal. Legal restrictions don't stop abortion from happening. They physically, emotionally, and financially punish people seeking abortion care, and they disproportionately harm people with the fewest resources. Ahmed called for investments in sexual and reproductive health to improve the safety and health of women. Abortion is part of a basic human right to control one's reproductive destiny. So we think the countries and partners around the world should be investing in sexual and reproductive health and the full package, including access to safe abortion. And if they want to ensure that people can control their reproductive autonomy and make the decisions that are best for them and their families. And next up from Stat News, the FDA approved the abortion pill 20 years ago. It's time to make it available via telehealth. 20 years ago this month, the Food and Drug Administration approved a medication destined to become known as the abortion pill. Mifepristone, then called RU486, was going to change everything about abortion. It would expand access and remove the stigma. I remember devouring the news because this little pill was going to give women reproductive autonomy and let them control if and when they have children. At the time, I was just starting my PhD in public health. The news inspired and exhilarated me, and I knew that the abortion pill is what I wanted to focus my career on. Medication abortion is a safe, effective alternative to procedural abortion. It involves taking 2 prescribed medications, mifepristone followed by misoprostol, to end a pregnancy that is no further than 11 weeks along. Fast forward to today. Many of the barriers to abortion that existed in September 2000 still exist today. Nearly 90% of U.S. countries have no abortion provider, and my research has found that 27 major cities are, quote, abortion deserts, where residents must travel 100 miles or more to reach an abortion provider. The introduction of the abortion pill didn't have the effect I was hoping for, partly because the FDA placed a strict set of rules known as risk evaluation mitigation strategy on mifepristone. Among these restrictions is a requirement that mifepristone be dispensed in a clinic, doctor's office, or hospital, effectively prohibiting clinicians from prescribing it during a telehealth visit. In addition to these FDA restrictions, 19 states specifically banned provision of the abortion pill via telehealth for purely political reasons. As a public health scientist and expert on abortion safety, I know that these restrictions are outdated and medically unnecessary. Over the past 20 years, almost 4 million pregnant people in the U.S. have used these 2 medications to end their pregnancies. In a study my colleagues and I did among more than 11,000 individuals who had a medication abortion, the safety rate was more than 99%. Regardless of where patients obtain the pills, they will almost certainly take them at home. In other words, receiving a prescribed pill in person from a doctor at a clinic versus getting it at a pharmacy or by mail makes it no more or less likely a patient will need emergency care. Medication abortion is easily administered via telehealth. In the context of COVID-19, social distancing, and increasingly scarce medical services, make it essential that state and federal governments put politics aside to allow patients access to abortion care via telehealth instead of trying to further restrict abortion care. Abortion restrictions that were in place before COVID-19 mean that some states have only a single abortion provider, and if that provider or the staff at clinics must self-quarantine, patients have even fewer options. For many patients, postponing an abortion can mean not getting one at all. Amid a pandemic, these restrictions put lives at risk because patients still must travel long distances to get to a clinic. In July, a federal judge ruled that the in-person requirement for medication abortion poses a substantial obstacle during the pandemic and are unconstitutional. In states where the practices are not specifically prohibited, a clinician can now prescribe the abortion pill via telehealth and the medications can be delivered by mail, but only temporarily. This is a move in the right direction, but it is time to permanently lift the medically unwarranted risk evaluation and mitigation strategy. Clinic-to-clinic telehealth programs exist in some states, But even so, they require patients to come to a clinic for tests and to get the pills. The only at-home telehealth program for abortion is a study currently operating in 11 states with approval from the FDA. But even with this program, in which patients have a telehealth consultation and can then receive abortion pills by mail, this model still requires them to obtain an ultrasound from a clinic to confirm that the pregnancy is within the gestational time limit, which may be difficult under present conditions and is not required for abortion care. Evidence has shown that calculating gestation based on a patient's known date of last menstrual period is highly accurate for dating pregnancies. Telehealth for abortion expands access to underserved areas, including in rural areas where there are no providers. Telehealth can contribute to patient-centered care by offering an additional choice that meets patient needs for convenience and privacy. If telehealth makes it possible to have abortion sooner, it may make abortion safer by moving all medication abortions to earlier in pregnancy. Ensuring that people can get abortions as early as possible may not seem urgent in the light of the COVID-19 pandemic, but delayed abortion care can prevent people from having wanted abortions, dramatically altering their life trajectories. It is more urgent than ever that policymakers at both federal and state levels stop blocking telehealth access to mifepristone and start prioritizing science and public safety over politics. Okay, well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. If you'd like to re-listen to this show, queue up past shows or future shows, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Or if you want to like the Facebook page, search on Facebook for Just for the Health of It, WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.